Hi, everyone. Welcome to the MRP Tech Podcast. This is episode 106. My name is Matt, and this is the weekly podcast discussing everyday tech for everyday people. And in this week's episode, I'm going to interview an audio engineer friend of mine who I've been waiting to get on this show for a really long time. I'm really excited to introduce you to him. So without any further ado, I'd just like to introduce Danny Lee from Danimal Sound. Hey, Danny, how's it going?
Hey, Matt. Pleasure to be here, man. Thanks for inviting me on.
So welcome to the show. I am super excited to have you on because I have been for a very long time wanting to get an audio engineer on the show and talk about some things that if anybody interested in audio engineering or recording or producing of any kind, just from a person who has been trained professionally to do this type of thing. And I'm really excited to hear what you have to say in your thought process and all of that, those type of things. So let's start the show right out front. What I would like to do is Danny is an old friend of mine from college, and we went to school together at a community college near Albany, New York. And so Danny, let's start off. What is it that you do for a living, basically?
Well, I do hold a day job, just for the whole stability thing and benefits and whatnot. But I moonlight as an audio engineer, mixer, and I want to say producer, but I prefer the role of co-producer because sometimes it's less responsibility.
I can definitely see that. So basically, like most people, you have your day job and you have things you're interested in. You work sort of on the side as an audio engineer and mixer. And how long have you been doing this?
In any capacity, probably since my late high school, early college days when I, you know, first discovered that I could use my dad's old cassette recorder and, you know, play along with myself on two different tracks. You know, it definitely progresses from there as technology kind of follows your interest and you kind of figure things out.
So you started pretty young. You had an interest in music. Are you a musician yourself?
Yeah. If you might recall, you and I actually met in the music program at SUNY Schenectady, SCCC. I was there as a music business major with a concentration in classical solo guitar performance, but I was also in the ensemble. I'm not sure if you recall that or not. You and I actually had music theory together, I believe, to start out.
I totally remember. I just was I was teasing the audience, and I wanted to bring it up that you're a guitar player. In fact, I often remember quite often every day as I would show up to the school, you would be out in the lobby playing guitar nonstop. So I do remember that. I do remember taking guitar class with you. And actually, one of my sort of on a side topic, one of my favorite classes that we took together, I don't know if you remember this, was actually an astronomy class. Do you remember the astronomy class?
Yes. Was it one or two?
I don't remember which one it was, but all I remember...
Yeah, there was a German professor by the name of Rolf Schauer, I believe.
And I couldn't think of his name, and I was going to ask you, and I'm so glad that you remembered his name. That was probably one of the most fantastic classes I took in my entire undergrad career. His German accent made astronomy so much fun to learn from, and I remember you loved it just as much, probably.
Oh yeah, I mean, actually, one of the footprints in my head of why I remember him so well is one of my co-guitarists. His name is Mark from SCCC. He took the same class but on a different schedule, and he did this great impression of Professor Schauer. He used to say "liquid hot magma," like very, very articulately, and I'll never ever forget.
Yep. So I remember those things too, and I think, you know, on this show I talk quite a bit about space topics. I talk about the space station. I talk about SpaceX and rockets and that type of stuff. And, you know, I've always kind of had an interest in that, but my interest my interest really peaked in that class when everything just, you know, he blew my mind, from, you know, day after day we took that class. So yeah, we did go to the same school together, and you were music business major.
Correct.
What's involved with a music business major for those that don't know?
Well, fortunately for me, it was less intense requirements than people like yourself taking, you know, education and whatnot, and the performance variety. There was a few classes. Well, there was actually a history of, I forget the exact name. Sorry, it was like music history or something like that. But there was like a brief, like one or two semester course about that as far as like modern recording history.
Okay.
And it followed kind of like the business from the onset of, you know, when people, I should say that the business aspect of basically from recorded music, like when you could purchase a recording, because obviously there was business before that, you know, with, you know, composers long before with live performances. But when we started actually, you know, putting music on a recordable medium, the history of that type of thing, and going through like, you know, publishing and sort of the business aspect of that. I'm really rusty on publishing and licensing and things of that nature, but we did discuss how record labels work and that type of thing. And, you know, if you were someone who was looking to be like a recording artist, you know, how to get noticed by people who could, you know, further you in that arena. Of course, this was 1999 when I took this class, so things have drastically changed since. You know, a lot of the information's old hat at this point.
Absolutely. You know, and that was actually what I was just going to say, is it's really important to talk about how music was recorded, say, 100 years ago. Well, not quite 100 years ago. You know, when
it...
Almost. I think in 1920, I think, is the first recording, or somewhere around there. The original Dixieland jazz band or something like that, the first jazz recording. So, yeah, the technology has changed. And, you know, one of the things I explain to my students all the time is you can go and listen to those old recordings. They don't sound great. And that's not because the music was bad. It's because the technology wasn't there. And you right. know, now, you know, and back then you didn't have things where you could edit. You had one take.
Right.
Or you had to cut the tape and splice together, you know, and sure. Not a lot of people do that these days. So the technology has gotten better. And now you were saying this earlier, sort of off air, that, you know, the production business has changed so much that you don't go into a studio really anymore and sit with four engineers in a sound room recording. A lot of people are sure. doing it in their garage or their basement or that type of thing. So that's yeah. sort of where we're headed with this episode today, talking about audio engineers who do this as a hobby, who just want to get in and learn about it. And what does it take to be an audio engineer from your perspective?
Well, actually, if I could just backtrack for like 10 seconds,
sure.
You mentioned about the recording quality and then, like, you know, listening to older stuff to get a vibe for how the times were, and, you know, and people kind of criticizing, you know, with modern ears, criticizing an old recording, say like on a vinyl or a tape or something. But I do have to say, this comes up a lot in discussions online, even these days, about like, you know, MP3 quality or blah, 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 you know, basically the medium or the format. But the common denominator is, regardless of how the recording sounds, the performance is what's most captivating, and that can basically supersede the format or the quality of the playback.
So you're saying the quality of the musicians, if you're recording music, is probably the most important thing.
Sure. And that's why even like a person like yourself or myself or any of your students might go into a library and listen to an archived recording from way, way back, you know, 1920s even, Edison cylinder type stuff. They probably won't readily discount the recording because the performance kind of holds its water, I guess you could say. So it's still enjoyable to listen to regardless of how it actually sounds.
And the best part about that, too, again, is the technology over time has changed to be able to go back and clean up some of those audio recordings from back in the day. I've got a good friend of mine that I work with that, just as a side hobby, he goes back and cleans up old Artie Shaw big band recordings. And it's just a hobby he loves to do. He figured out how to clean up the audio, and he's doing it, you know, and helping people out. So do you ever work on cleaning up audio at all in your sort of hobby?
I've done it sort of in like an indirect sort of in a way. There's two kind of examples I can think of offhand. One, I was actually involved. This is actually how I met my wife.
Awesome.
But back in 2009, I was on an audio post crew for a film that unfortunately never actually came out. It had a lot of difficulties and things, but it was an independent film, mostly shot over at HVCC in Troy. Anybody listening, that's upstate New York area. It's a college. And certain things there, we were doing what's called ADR. And basically, not to go into like this long tangent, but when you're on set for a film application, you do have what's called location audio. And then you also have post-production audio. I'm kind of being general here, but essentially you have what's called a boom operator or a boom mic. And for those people that watch like a lot of behind the scenes type stuff for filmmaking and whatever, it's usually it's a guy with headphones on and he's got a large like telescopic stand in his hands, and it's kind of hovering over the actors or the talent or, you know, whoever's doing the talking. And then basically in post-production, any of that that's usable, they will keep. But then you've probably seen stuff like in making of Lord of the Rings and things like really high budget stuff where you'll see actors re-recording essentially their dialogue from the set in a proper studio, you know, with like a $10,000, you know, signal chain. And basically what they're doing is they're doing a combination of doing what you just mentioned, the audio cleanup. If you're on like a really loud set or in a natural setting, like, you know, forest or what have you, there's going to be background noise that you just cannot combat. But you're, even if you don't intend to use that audio later on, if you can't clean it up, they will re-record the dialogue in a studio, and the actor has to sit in the vocal booth and basically sync up to their own mouth on the screen and re-perform the audio aspect of that performance.
That's really great. I didn't realize that you were into other things besides recording music. So you are used to working in audio in multiple fields. What was it like to kind of work on a movie set, even if it was?
Yeah, I've been around.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome, man.
Yeah, it was interesting. It can be high stress because it can be long hours, like being in a recording studio with a band. But in this case, you've got a lot more people in a lot more facets of something that you've got to kind of corral together and be organized. So you've got everyone from personal assistants who are, you know, doing a coffee run to, you know, the actual talent, you know, the director of photography who's basically behind the camera, you know, director. So there's a lot of energy to manage and whatnot. But it can also be very tricky in the post-production area.
I'm sure.
If you've got someone who's not familiar with doing what's called ADR. I'm not sure if I actually explained that, but it's basically stands for automated dialogue replacement.
Okay.
I'm not really sure where the automated part came from, because the actors are doing this, for lack of a better word, manually.
That's true.
But backtrack, but another thing about the location versus the studio audio is, like I said, even if they intend to replace the audio later, because it's just too much background noise, like vehicles or whatever the setting might have been, they will still record the location audio so the actors can at least have like a reference track, you know, to hear their original performance, even if it's got background noise and whatnot, and, you know, to kind of, you know, cue off of that.
That's really neat. So as an audio engineer, you sort of have to be a person of many hats. You have to be able to adjust based on your environment. I'm sure there's a lot of difference between recording in a studio, recording out in the field somewhere, and even a live performance. Am I right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And actually, I wanted to get back to, as far as audio cleanup, there was another situation I was in. For a little while, I was doing mixing for a colleague of mine over in England, who was doing a series of basically gospel concerts, and he was, how do I want to describe this? He was basically the live sound reinforcement. You know, he would provide the stage, the stage plot, you know, the PA system, et cetera, et cetera. And then we kind of hooked up through mutual friends on Facebook and whatnot. And he was looking for someone to kind of, you know, he wanted to offer recording service basically along with that. So he would record that live multi-track during the show, and then he would have me, you know, remix a couple shows.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And there were a couple times where I kind of had to cut my teeth with, a little bit more advanced, sound, repair, I guess you would call it, where, you know, you might have like a bad vocal mic, but they don't realize that through the PA system, because when you're recording live, you don't hear like everything. You've got audience noise and all that going on. But when you've got this isolated signal, you know, you're listening to it in your studio room, you can hear like, you know,
the 60 hertz hum and that type of thing.
Yeah, not only that, but even stuff that happens where you might have like a faulty mic cable connection in the microphone itself, and the singer is handling it roughly during their performance, and you might have like some undesirable clicks or pops.
Okay, I got you.
That result from like, you know, the electricity and whatnot. So you've got to somehow save that track.
That sounds like a real chore, actually.
Yeah, actually, if anyone's interested in doing this, I actually used there's a company called Isotope. They make really good stuff. And I used a specific plugin from their RX suite. It's called D-Clipper. And that actually was successful in that maneuver for me. So
wow.
If anyone has that problem who's listening to Matt's podcast here, I would definitely give that a whirl. They've got, you know, free trials and such.
Well, Matt has had that problem on many occasions recording music. So I'm going to keep that in mind. Okay, so let's move along and let's talk about working in a studio in itself, whether it's a home studio or an actual recording studio. You obviously there's a lot to it. And speaking of all the different connections, microphones, cables, that type of stuff, you really sort of have to have a lot of attention to detail in order to come off with a successful recording.
Sure.
What are some other things that you come up with like on a daily basis that you've got to deal with as a recording engineer?
It depends. I've kind of made my focal point mixing lately, the last couple of years. So I'm not doing a lot of recording, but I have kind of had a resurgence of some vocal and guitar overdubbing lately. I can talk about that later.
Okay.
But you might have things where, you know, people have, you know, sent you stuff that's, you know, mixed file formats, or, you know, the parameters are different. Like, you know, one sets, you know, 24-bit versus 16 or things like that. The biggest problem I'll have is if someone wants me to mix a song and they haven't bothered to pay attention to labeling their tracks appropriately. So, you know, someone might have, you know, this inspiration late at night wherever they're recording, and, you know, they'll just, you'll get a whole folder full of, you know, audio 1 through 16 or something, or, you know, and you'll have all these just kind of random file names, and you've kind of got to make heads or tails of that.
Okay. And so let's talk about your editing process. Do you use any specific types of software when you're mixing? What's your go-to bag of tools, so to speak?
Well, for processing, as far as like tone shaping, things like that, I have a steady palette. I draw from a couple companies that I love on a consistent basis. I'll use EQs and compressors by Waves, Slate Digital, and sometimes I'll use a company called UAD, which stands for Universal Audio Digital, basically. They're the oldest of the three because they've actually been around since the 1950s.
Okay. And as far as like recording software that you use if you were to record something, what are you using there?
Right now I'm actually strictly Avid Pro Tools. I've actually been on that software since version 6 in 2003. And actually that's what I trained on in production school.
Okay.
At the time it was basically like, you know, the kingpin DAW, and then its arch nemesis was Apple's Logic.
Absolutely.
Which I think was version 8 or 9 at the time when I started studying formally. So oh, I'm sorry to cut you off.
Oh, that's okay. Go ahead.
But then, yeah, when I was in school, basically, the three top dogs that I remember were basically Avid Pro Tools, Apple Logic, and then I just remembered Motu's Digital Performer, which was very, is it's still around. It's very close to Pro Tools.
Yeah, and you know, the more that I talk to recording engineers, audio engineers, it seems like Pro Tools is the way to go for that professional quality. There are free alternatives out there, but I know a guy. Just a few weeks ago, you and I were talking about Ubuntu Studio, which is a free and open source operating system based off of audio video production, and that's great to sort of get started in the hobby. And I've known a recording guy that has released several albums using free and open source software. But after a while, I just talked with him recently, and he's on Pro Tools, you know, just because It's that's the way most people go. They're using Pro Tools. So it makes total sense to me that if it's not broken, what's the saying? If it's not
if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, exactly. So you learned
some would argue that there are things about Pro Tools that are broken and have never been fixed, but we just kind of pony up and go along for the ride.
Yeah. So that we're going to get into another discussion too coming up soon about Macs. But you're a Mac user, right?
I am. I actually in my day job I actually use Windows like everybody else in an office environment. But I was turned on to the Apple platform back in I think it was 2003 when I started production school, and I kind of really took to the operating system the way it's laid out.
Absolutely. And being musicians, most musicians end up going way of Mac, or artists in general, I should say, graphics designers, photographers, musicians.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny you say that though, I think it's like a default that sort of happened, naturally. I remember a discussion with a college classmate at a SECC actually way back. This was probably like 2001 or 2002. When I was doing some extra classes there. And at that point, Mac was basically like the go-to platform for anything that's multimedia driven.
Yep.
And there was actually a deal for the longest time when Pro Tools first made the leap to like the prosumer, I guess you could call it. Because before that, you could only get the high definition system that, costs like 80 grand for, a proper, like commercial recording facility. But when they first came to the home user line, it was Macintosh only. There was no Windows driver for this system. So I think that's an important thing to kind of plug into the timeline here to give a little backstory as to why that's still kind of the case. Windows kind of had to catch up as far as who was willing to write for them, basically.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That's really neat.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's been so long since that was the case, though, that I we kind of forget about that type of thing. But if you sit back and, remember, like, wow, I remember when this was, Windows only or Mac only, and you had to kind of get that, compatibility issue sorted out.
Yeah, so I basically switched to Mac, I think around 2008. My older brother had switched to Mac just before that, and, he was a Finale user that switched to Sibelius. He was a Windows user that wanted to record, and his Windows XP computer would just crash all the time. So he switched to Mac and never went back. And so he finally convinced me to switch to Mac. And when I first got my first MacBook Pro, I wanted a mobile recording studio so that I could go. Yep. I wanted to be able to record my band when I went out and played. And so sure. I bought some Personas hardware and got set up with a way to record. And it was great. Worked flawlessly. And so over time, I would use the free software. I'd use GarageBand or I'd use iMovie and the free software that came with it. But over time, I would notice that with each software upgrade, the quality seemed to get less and less. And so they would take away features that I really used or I really enjoyed. And then, right. then as time went on, they started removing, they removed FireWire from their computers and that wasn't yep. being used. and so then all of a sudden you need an adapter for everything. I was curious from your perspective as an audio engineer, how that has affected what you do on Mac.
It's a pain to generalize. Well, the one thing I wanted to say real quick though was I'm sort of obsessed with the I haven't seen the second one, but the first Steve Jobs film starring Ashton Kutcher.
Oh yeah,
I quote that like till I'm blue in the face, regardless of what the situation is.
So, would you consider yourself an Apple fanboy?
I guess for the lack of a better term. But one thing I wanted to quote specifically from that movie that as far as what turned me on to the Mac OS initially. Not only was it just a nice, nice GUI, but I'm not sure if Jobs actually said this in real life, but in the script, there was a point where Ashton Kutcher's character was kind of criticizing, I think it was the Lisa or maybe a similar model that never actually came to fruition, but he came out and said, I want this this product to function like an appliance. I don't want you to have to be a software engineer to run this thing.
Right.
So I think that kind of spoke to me too, as far as like when I first got introduced to macOS, just how clean it was, the lack of options as far as, you know, when Pro Tools first came out for Windows, you should have seen the installation manual for this thing as far as when they give you like system optimizations.
Oh, I bet.
It's, you know, several gigs long, or not gigs, I should say, but, you know, several pages longer than what a Mac would have to go through to be considered optimized to perform. I mean, you got to go in and tick all those little, you know, hundreds of boxes that they have under the hood. And, you know, in Mac, they're just saying like, you know, don't use a screensaver, don't put disk to sleep, done.
Yeah. And so when you sit down, you just want to get work done. You don't want to have to fight to make things work.
Oh, absolutely. And as far as the adapters and stuff goes, I'm assuming you're talking about basically the latest lines of MacBook Pros and stuff specifically.
Absolutely.
But yeah, there's even videos online that on YouTube specifically that mock the loss of all these different connections. And there's a video that basically says, you know, we're Apple and we love dongles. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but basically it's actually like a Spanish interview.
I was just thinking of that one myself. There is it is the most hysterical thing I have ever seen. And I'll put a link in the show notes if I think it is definitely not PC. You know, it's not.
Sure.
It's definitely over the line on many occasions, but I have not laughed that hard in a long time when I saw that. And I'll share it I'll put the link in the show notes. I'll try to find it.
Yeah, sure. And like with the new lines, I mean, some people are for and against whatever, but I mean, you know, when I first read that, you know, the first thing to go was obviously the optical drive. And that's actually why I bought my current MacBook, which is an aging 2012. It was, I think the 13s were just coming out and I was trading my other MacBook in, and basically, me being me, I opted to go for the model that was, you know, kind of dying its death for the 13s to come out. But I made that decision because I insisted on keeping an optical drive. But more importantly, I wanted to keep my matte screen because they no longer offer that option. So.
Oh, right. Yeah, they're all glossy now.
Yeah, I don't know why anyone would invent something that looks more like a mirror than a screen. So
yeah, and it's tough. The glossy screens are tough for any time, like photo editing, that type of thing. You just never know what you're going to get when you want to print a photo out and that type of thing.
Sure. Yeah, and even a buddy of mine that runs a local studio over in Albany, New York, he recently stopped buying refurbished MacBooks, which was his preference prior, and he went with a brand new one. I believe he bought the 2017 model that had just come out. And we talk about this stuff ad nauseum, basically via text message and Facebook. And he sent me a screenshot of his, like, you know, final receipt when he'd purchased the new model, and it was ridiculous, because obviously you're familiar with this. They basically went all USB-C, I believe. Yep. It's like four ports on the top model. And because of this, to get it to interface with everything he already owns for his audio work, he's literally spent $400 in adapters.
Wow. That's just outrageous.
I kid you not.
That is
outrageous.
I can
privately send you a screenshot of this receipt.
I believe you. And that's sort of where the market is going. You know, that's, they make tons of money off of these things, and they definitely know what they're doing. But you know, I'm not somebody who wants the thinnest laptop out there. I don't need the new shiny. I just need to be able to plug
it. No, I need the power and I want it to work.
Exactly. You know, so, sure. So my computer's an i7 and it does all the work that I need it to do, but boy, you know, there have been many changes in it, and I keep talking with, you know, musicians, recording engineers that are out there, and every single person, that's their complaint, is they feel sort of taken advantage of by Mac. And I don't know if you feel that way, but I certainly do in some cases.
I definitely don't feel like Jobs may have been in favor of these moves had he still been here.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
That's a good point.
I actually had just recently read, there's a company I follow online. They're now called generally Production Expert, but I follow the Pro Tools Expert branch of them exclusively, just because that's the system I use. But They have some excellent blogs. If anyone out there is looking to get into this stuff, they do lots of great reviews as far as, you know, recording, you know, hardware like mic preamps. They run the gamut as far as what they review, and their reviews are very in-depth. But they actually just recently published an article. I think it was a third-party company. They didn't do it themselves, but it was like connections they had with another, you know, tech company. And they had done like an overview of the brand new MacBook 2018 model that just came out. And basically, they kind of ripped it to shreds as far as its construction and its clock speeds, I guess, with the 6-core architecture versus in the i9, I believe it is, now that they put out, against the prior model, saying that basically with its inability to cool itself properly, basically you're hitting the same benchmarks as you know, the prior year technology.
That's really interesting, because just this past week, an IT friend of mine sent me a message saying I had posted a post online about the new MacBook books being released, and he basically said, "Don't go anywhere near them; they're junk." And so now you're the second person that's told me that, and you've actually, you know, had some details why that's the case. It's really kind of interesting.
Yeah, and the thing is too, like another one of the complaints that these people had, and they do actually buy one. Obviously, they don't get it free from Apple, but they did actually have like not screenshots, but photos of them actually disassembling it, because they need to see what's in there and how it's put together. And I'm not sure if this was the case with the 2017 model, but with the 2018, even the hard drive is now glued and soldered in place.
Are you
so
kidding?
Basically, anything you want to modify has to be done by Apple.
That is, and of course you're going to take it to an Apple store, and if you have to travel like me, the closest Apple store is 3 hours away, and then they're going to charge you for the diagnostics fee, and they're going to charge you.
Sure.
It just, they know what they're doing all the way around. All right, so
yeah, and it's crazy, because I mean, and that's actually, I mean, I don't know if we want to talk about this at all, but basically, because I no longer do much, if any, mobile recording, I'm actually looking to get back into a desktop for my next Apple machine. But I've actually been heavily researching the Hackintosh community recently.
And
I'm not sure if that's something you can touch on.
Absolutely.
Or not,
we'll talk a little bit about that. I remember you asking me about the Hackintosh thing. I tried to build a Hackintosh several times on a low spec laptop at one point in time, and a low spec desktop. I could get everything installed, and I got everything kind of working. But anytime there was an update, I just shut everything down, and it wouldn't work. You know, drivers, I'd have issues with all sorts of things. And so I guess, sure, I sort of got away from it. I will say that I never really researched it deeply, and I know that there are people out there that have, lots of success with Hackintoshes. So I'd be curious in the future, if you do build one, just update me and tell me exactly how you did it.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I'm sure I will have a detailed manual on my endeavor.
That's great. Okay. So we've got our Apple bashing in there, and so let's move on. Let's go back to audio engineering. And what are some of the current projects that you're working on now? What's sort of your style? What do you like to do the most?
Well, just because of the way I grew up, I mostly enjoy like the harder side of things, hard rock, some heavy metal, things like that. I've done a few projects of singer-songwriter, which can be cool in its own right. It's, you know, I do like some variety here and there. Years and years ago, I had done some hip-hop and R&B, but I felt that I wasn't really, what's the word I'm looking for, apt. I didn't have an aptitude, I guess, for those genres, and, you know, I didn't grow up with that, so I don't have an ear for what things should be like, and, you know, I enjoy my drums and my guitars more. So
absolutely. So obviously you're a big fan of rock and metal. What are some of your favorite bands out there?
Well, anybody who knows me who's listening to this will probably sit there and lip sync and say Metallica's Black Album is,
of
like,
course,
my Ark of the Covenant, so to speak, as far as what I listen to for reference.
Absolutely.
Ironically, though, I mean, given the state of today's metal and how clean everything sounds with obviously all this digital wizardry we have going on, some of my favorite records, including that one, were actually cut on tape and mixed on tape. I mean, it was, you know, early 90s here, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're listening to real performances.
Absolutely.
But some stuff I've actually been working on lately. There's a band called King's Castle from upstate New York. They're actually kind of divided across the northeastern seaboard at this point. It's more of a side project. King's Castle is one word. I mixed most of the tracks on a 10th anniversary album, but it's more like an 11th anniversary album from the first record I did with them. I didn't actually engineer anything. I just mixed it, but that's currently being mastered by Mr. Josh Mirsky. Another project I'm currently actually starting to mix, there's a local guitar virtuoso from the Ballston Spa, Saratoga area, by the name of Carm Grasso. And if anyone wants to hear what he sounds like, I'm currently mixing the second installment of what would be a trilogy, but we keep adding stuff to it. But the album we put out last year together, which I mixed, is called Mixed Signals. You guys can look that up on Apple Music or whatever you use for music consumption. I mixed that. It's instrumental rock, and he's a solid performer. And actually, while we're at it, that's a good point to touch on if I can go on a slight tangent.
Yeah, go ahead.
With today's technology, people work remotely very easily. And on Carm's projects, what I end up doing, like our formula together, is he's already got his guitar tracks cut to a click track or like a drum loop, so to speak, at a fixed tempo. He'll have me actually write and program MIDI drums and bass to the song. And then upon approval from him, he actually found a couple people online over in England who are basically for hire drummers and bassists he found on some music forums. He'll send them the tracks via Dropbox or some other medium, and I'll send them a rough mix without the instruments and then a reference so they can hear the parts that I wrote just to kind of go off of. And then they'll send the raw audio back to me through him, and then I'll put it all together.
And that, to me, is one of the most incredible things about the current state of technology. We talked earlier about how 100 years ago or so, the technology wasn't there, and it has progressively gotten better. And now we're to the point where in the click of a second, you can send audio files halfway across the planet, have them record, and another click of the second, it's back, and we could never have that before. And what a wonderful thing that is to be able to have those interactions with all around the world. I mean, musicians are musicians everywhere, you know, just like people are people everywhere. And so that's really cool. And just a few weeks ago, I had a really awesome opportunity to meet with one of the MuseScore developers. I'm not sure if you're familiar with MuseScore at all.
I saw it mentioned on one of your podcasts, and I'm definitely meaning to go check that out because I really like the way you review things, and I just put a bug in my ear, so I will check that out.
Cool. So MuseScore is just like Finale or Sibelius. It's a music notation software, and I saw a post on Facebook about the new MuseScore beta that's coming out, and I just approached them and said, hey, I got a show. Let's do an interview. And I thought they were, you know, located in California or something like that, and
Silicon Valley, Cupertino.
Yeah, exactly. And sure enough, this guy was in Kaliningrad, Russia, you know, 4,900 miles away. And how cool is that to be just talking with somebody halfway across the planet, you know? And
it's amazing.
And so to be able to collaborate with somebody across the planet music-wise, that's the coolest thing. And just like you said earlier, you had a friend in England who you were working on some recording projects. I mean, all of that, that's just amazing. It amazes me. So let's talk about your recording process. I'm sure there's a process for pre-recording and recording and post-recording. And for anybody interested in getting into this type of field, how do you do it?
Well, if I'm actually recording something, depends on what the actual, I guess, performance medium is going to be. Is, you know, as far as if it's just like a voiceover, stuff like that, or if it's something more complicated, like a full band type thing, you know, drummer, bassist, guitar, you know, whatever the configuration, I guess would be the better word. But as far as pre-recording, I definitely want to have them as prepared and rehearsed as humanly possible, because I've definitely run the gamut of experiences as far as, you know, who the serious guys are and who are just kind of, you know, not as serious, I guess is the nicest way to put it.
So you don't like to work with the people that show up and want to write the songs on the spot?
Oh, sure. Oh, don't even get me started. There's actually been a couple times where I've even rented out a friend's, you know, house or building or wherever they're set up, because I didn't have the space for a given project. And, you know, 9 times out of, maybe it's 80%, but, you know, whatever. it's up there. You'll get in there and you're ready to hit record and make the magic happen, capture the performance. And then, you know, the most generic problem that keeps coming up, they stop halfway through the song, and then someone's yelling in the mic saying, you know, you went too long, or that wasn't enough, you know, bars of that given section. And then we start the head scratching, and, you know, who's got it written down somewhere? Nobody does.
That makes for a long day.
In the other room thinking, you guys have performed this on stage before.
Yeah. What a pain.
You know, without issue. How did this happen?
Crazy.
But yeah, rehearsal is definitely a huge thing. And I mean, one thing I wanted to point out too, even for, I'm not sure where this would fit in the process, maybe just recording, but even as far as working with talent goes, I've even had years and years ago, I worked with a hard rock band doing a demo, and I'd probably spent, I want to say probably 40 to 60 hours actually cutting up their drum tracks and prepping them to be nice for, you know, guitar overdubs and all that. That's just a window as far as how much work I'd already put into this.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
I upload these files to Dropbox for the vocalist to rehearse to. Keep this in mind. And 90 days go by before we actually set up a time, you know, to come to my house to start tracking vocals. The guy comes over, puts his headphones on. I hit playback, and all of a sudden he's saying, you know, the guitar sound doesn't sound right, or not how he remembered, or what have you.
Oh boy.
And I sit there and I instantly go, have you by chance not heard this yet? and he goes, and he's just like, no, this is my first time hearing it. I'm like, did you get the link I sent you 3 months ago? Oh. Yep. Nice.
Yeah. So it's not your fault at that point. It's his fault.
No, it's just one of those things. It just kind of irks you to no end. You know, sometimes people don't really understand the amount of elbow grease that goes into prepping files and getting them ready for certain parts of production. And then,
yeah, let's talk about that. So you have, let's say you have a 4 minute track of a song and maybe 10 different channels of audio that have been recorded. How long do you think you normally spend in the editing process for a four or five minute long song?
Well, that can vary greatly, honestly. It depends on the artist and, you know, their ability level, how well rehearsed they are. Because, I mean, I've literally had drummers, for instance, that I actually haven't had to touch. They're just dead on with the click track. They're super tight. And everyone involved has been doing it for long enough that it's sort of second nature when they record. So, I mean, you know, I might have to just maybe do a couple splices here and there just to slide things around on the timeline. But if I'm going to, you know, make a performance, for lack of a better word, super tight, and that includes them saying, you know, if you want to cut it up beat by beat, then, you know, we approve of that. You know, that could be, for a 5 minute song, that would typically take me 2 to 3 hours to cut up those drums and then reconsolidate them. But, you know, like I said, it could vary by the material. Sometimes the singer might need tuning as well, or, you know, it just depends on what the material calls
for. So it can be a time consuming process, that's for sure.
Very much so, yeah.
Okay, so let's say somebody listening to this podcast, a high school student or just anybody in general that just wants to sort of test the water about, you know, home recording, or just wants to learn about the field. What would you recommend now? Pretend you're that high school kid that you were back in the 1990s, you know, interested in music. What would you recommend to them now to sort of get started in the field?
Well, it depends on what facet, I guess, they're interested in, because live sound tends to be booming quite a bit with lots of, you know, venues that are popping up and event companies, things of that nature. So there's lots of opportunity for that. And even, honestly, even contacting people is so much easier now with social media. Because if you wanted to go that route and just kind of get your feet wet, not even looking at, you know, a formal education program, but just to be around that environment, you can simply just go to some sort of local Facebook group that you might look up and see what's going on there and message people. But as far as looking into actual, like, the education aspect and you know, coursework, things like that, there's actually so many, I don't want to call them, they're not like accredited programs, but I'm not sure if you have a term for that I could use, but there's a lot of education now that's available online by like smaller entities, and some of them are a subscription basis where you can learn a lot of recording and post-production stuff where they actually send you files that you can work on and learn along with them.
So sort of like a mentoring program, you're going to pay for lessons, just doing it virtually now instead of meeting with somebody and working on their hardware. And yeah. So a lot of things are online. Have you taught anyone locally in your area, or have you mentored anybody in recording or anything like that?
Not since probably about 10 years ago. Honestly, it's been that long since I worked for WAMC Northeast Public Radio briefly on the engineering team there. Not so much in the broadcast department, though I did do some remote broadcasts with them, which was really fun, actually. But I worked mainly at this place called the Lyndon Norris Auditorium, which is directly across the street from the station, where I was a front-of-house mixer, and I did some recording there as well. We'd have college interns from audio programs come in once in a while, and not so much like shadow us per se, but kind of do like what I guess I would consider like student employee type work, where you'd have them, you know, like wrapping cables or helping with a stage plot, things of that nature.
Almost like an internship type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah, that's the last time I kind of did anything like that, which was, you know, face to face. I have done some very specific, YouTube videos on my channel, which has been silent for a long time, unfortunately. But I haven't done much with that. I have taught guitar for a couple years and piano. Probably this is going back from 2006 to I think it was 2009 when I stopped doing it full time. So I do have somewhat of an education background, but not so much in the music production.
Okay, and so you're still playing guitar now?
I am. I'm trying to get the rust off a little bit. Cause
aren't we all? Aren't we all? I still say that. So that's cool. One thing I wanted to go back to is you mentioned voiceover work. Let's talk about some of the voiceover work that you've done.
As a talent or because I actually recently did a couple things. I'm not sure if they'll ever be put out in public. They were mainly for different firms' internal capacity, but
it could be as a talent or it could be as of something, someone you've recorded for various reasons, whatever you want to talk about.
Sure. Well, I've actually done both more recently. I was actually the talent. I don't really consider myself someone I'd want to listen to.
Neither.
You know, go on and on about, you know, some sort of, you know, company and its attributes and whatnot. But I, the same people over in the UK that I have contacts with, had some mutual friends there looking for, and they happened to hear my YouTube tutorials, and I guess they like my tone. I think I'm a little monotone and dry, but that's, you know, money's money, man.
That's right. That's right.
There were some, I want to call it a pilot program for some, I want to say sales pitches for some digital advertising companies. I think they were that I did some, copy reading for, that went over pretty well. And I did that in, if anyone's asking, I did that in Pro Tools where you actually have like a QuickTime file and you can just do your voiceover to that. Not to backtrack, but if anyone's looking to do any music post-production, I'm sorry, not music, film post-production with Pro Tools, I'm not sure if anything's changed with the recent updates to 2018 version, but at least through the version 12, it does require a QuickTime file to run video. That's just putting that out there. But other than that, I've actually done I did a brief stint with a local company called Working, I think they're called Working Pictures. Yeah, this was a couple years ago, actually, but it was a lot of fun. They're based in the like commercial park of Albany, New York.
Awesome.
And basically, I was hired there through LinkedIn, actually. So, guys, access your LinkedIn profiles because someone may be writing you. but yeah, I was hired there to do some voiceover engineering. I did a long format documentary with a local newscaster, actually, who was hired as the talent. She did very well with that. It was like a 3-day project. But it was actually an out-of-state project, which was even cooler. It wound up being on, you know, like when you take those guided tours,
yep,
at certain landmarks, it's, you get like that, the audio device, and it kind of knows where you are, like on the tour.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Basically it wound up being for that. It was actually for a, I believe it was a Civil War cemetery, but it was out, I think it was in like Ohio or Pennsylvania or somewhere like that. That was quite a bit of fun.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that because I work actually in the summertime. I work at a major tourist attraction. And a few years ago, we had a sort of throughout the attraction, we had various posts where visitors could dial a cell phone number and then they'd have some information read to them about what they were looking at. And it never really occurred to me that you actually, you know, somebody's got to sit there and record all of those things and you have to have an audio engineer do that. So that's pretty cool you know, especially it was a Civil War place you were talking about.
I believe it was. It's been a couple of years since I did it, but that's my best recollection.
Awesome. So like we said, your audio engineers are people of many hats, and there's so many different aspects that everyday folks don't necessarily even consider when it comes to that. And just like IT guys, you know, there's always a joke about IT people in the IT field that if everything is working fine, then everybody's like, why are we paying you to do this? And then as soon as everything breaks, they're like, why are we paying you to do this? That's all broke, you know? So same thing goes, I guess, in an audio engineer way, you know, if everything sounds great, you know, it's like, well, what do we need you for? And then, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, that's totally not exclusive to IT. I promise you that.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like when you're, even for film, really. I mean, you know, if something is edited properly, you don't know that it's edited.
I guess that's the sign of someone who's very talented.
Yeah, it's just it's the weirdest like paradigm to consider. Actually, as far as the VO thing and as far as the different facets of the field, another project I had done with Working Pictures was I believe her name is Heather White. She's from Saratoga, New York, I believe. Super, super gifted voice artist. It was a pleasure working with her. We actually did a really intense project for, I believe it was for a local credit union called Capcom. And literally it was just for I forget what you call it, but basically like when you call like any sort of corporate entity, maybe corporate's the wrong PC term to use, but you would get like a phone menu and then you'll have to press 2 or 5 or, you know, whatever your option is. This project, she was supplying the voice for that phone database. That was actually really interesting because I actually had to learn a new process there, because one of the parameters that was required of the company, trying to think of the name, Mono EULAW is actually what the files had to be created ultimately. So basically we're recording it like, you know, 44:1, 24-bit,
yeah,
you know, trying to get it to sound all pretty. But then I actually had to go online and look up how to get this code to work. I actually wound up using Terminal in Macintosh OS to make these conversions. But yeah, that's what it ended up being, was just the menu that you hear on the phone line.
Yeah, that's awesome. Before we go, one last thing we got to talk about. And back in the day, I remember you were a huge fan of, this has nothing to do with audio engineering, but I think it is an interesting topic, so we're going to talk about it on the show just because I'm interested. you've always seemed to have an interest in the history of Vikings and things like that, and you recently took a trip to Iceland. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. It was actually my second overall trip there. My wife and I actually fell in love with the place originally on our actual honeymoon geez, a year and a half ago, year ago, something like that.
Great.
We kind of did sort of like a mini like UK Scandinavia tour sort of thing that we put together. Actually, for just putting it aside, I was actually born in the UK, just outside London. I was an Air Force brat. But we had put this tour together. I had gotten into sort of Norse mythology and Scandinavian language back in probably the late 90s when I was introduced to specifically Swedish death metal. You can go ahead and laugh, but it kind of grew on me. So I sort of took a liking to the culture and the Scandinavian languages. And then sort of indirectly, I'm not really sure how I landed on being interested in Iceland, but I think it was through all my Norse and Viking studies.
Okay.
It's sort of an alien land, and I gravitated towards basically the linguistic side of things, and then when I realized that how modern languages like Swedish and Norwegian are compared to the old languages, that's when I sort of kind of stumbled across Icelandic, which is basically a modern version of what we now call Old Norse, which is among the original languages spoken 1,000 years ago.
So you can actually speak the language?
To a degree. Icelandic, I'm sort of like a new student of. I actually study with a Norse group online monthly. We actually decode some sagas and stuff and actually study the language that way.
What's the name of that group?
I do have an intermediate knowledge of the Swedish language specifically.
Oh, nice. What's the name of the Norse group that you study with online?
They're actually called Hurstwick. It's Hurstwic.
Just for anybody out there who might be interested in learning how to speak Icelandic, that's pretty awesome. And I'm sure there's a big difference between living in New York and heading out to Iceland, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things is it's such an alien landscape. I mean, I'd seen pictures of it before, obviously, like, you know, when you're planning your trip and et cetera. But one of those moments that kind of stops your heart, but in a good way, if there's a good way. my wife and I had just begun our trip to London to see my family over there on my mother's side before heading out to the rest of actual Scandinavia peninsula. But we had a layover in Reykjavik, which is the capital of Iceland in the southwest. And the way the flight had kind of panned out was we were approaching Reykjavik right as the sun was coming up, and it was completely clear weather, which isn't common there. And just, I don't know, the sunrise, I'm even just getting chills now thinking about it, looking out the window of the plane. But seeing this like completely alien but gorgeous landscape, like volcanic lava fields, but like covered in like this shiny green moss. It was just vivid. And I just had like this kind of like otherworldly type of vibe to it. And when you land, it's just a completely different landscape. I know I keep saying that, but words cannot describe how different it is because, you know, there's basically no trees there. So, you know, you can see for miles and miles in most directions.
That's really interesting.
Lava fields and moss and, you know.
I guess I never thought about it that way. Oftentimes as a classroom teacher, we've got smart boards in the front of the room, and I'm always looking for sort of interesting backgrounds, desktop wallpapers to put on the screen just to start conversation with kids. Sure. And at one point in time, I was searching for waterfalls, and I came across probably one of the most beautiful pictures I've came across. And if you Google this term that I'm going to bring up in a minute, there's one iconic photo that I see every time I look up this waterfall. And I'm probably going to mispronounce it, so you can tell me if I'm mispronouncing it. I think it's called Godafoss or Godafoss. How do you pronounce that?
It's actually just Godafoss. Godafoss. That what looks like a D, depending on where you're looking, it's actually a... it's a special character called Ev, which is basically like a, they call it a voiced sort of TH sound.
Okay. Can you say it again?
Godafoss.
Godafoss. Okay. So yeah. G-O-D-A-F-O-S-S. I think that's
correct.
Okay. So
yeah, that's really like the anglicized version, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly.
Interestingly enough, not to go on a tangent, but one of the cool things about that language is you know, how they've maintained, you know, their original spellings and characters. That and a couple other letters that are present in modern Icelandic were actually once English characters as well.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I didn't know that. So this is why I wanted to talk about it, because I'm interested in languages. I'm interested in how they all work together, and it's cool to see these different things picked up by different cultures. And so you're helping me with pronunciation. You actually went to that waterfall, am I right?
I did. However, I actually consulted with my wife about this before I put all my notes together, and I wanted to ask her about other places that she recalled, because she's got like this eidetic memory when it comes to travel and such.
Okay.
But what did I write on here? It's hard to read my notes. They're in orange. But there's actually a place that we really liked called Seljalandsfoss. That's actually this giant waterfall that you can walk behind, which is really cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. When we were there, it was really windy, and everyone's got, you know, their raincoats on, and everyone's got, like, GoPros out, and, you know, everyone's getting sprayed by this waterfall, but it's a killer experience.
Sort of
and
like...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sort of like a Niagara Falls type of thing.
Yeah, although there's nothing protecting you from it. So, I mean... yeah, you can literally walk up to like where the water is coming down, and if you are so bold, you can go under the water.
That's awesome.
But yeah, it's actually quite popular. I won't spell it out because it's kind of long on here, but if you want to put it in like maybe the show notes or
yeah,
something,
definitely.
I've got it written in our correspondence. The other one that's actually really cool, I mean, Iceland's covered in waterfalls, believe it or not. I guess it's maybe just because of the way the glaciers are and the geography, but there's another one called Skógafoss, and I bring that up. You may have seen it on my Instagram. It's actually very tall, but it's kind of, you know, it's sort of like in this, I want to call it like a rocky cul-de-sac,
oh,
for
really?
Lack of a better term. But the reason why this one is so significant to me is because it's been featured in countless Scandinavian heavy metal videos, and they've also used it in the TV show Vikings for a scene where Floki actually discovers Iceland per the, you know, historical accounts.
Okay. That's awesome. Any other highlights of the trip that you want to bring up?
Oh, sure. the thing is,
I mean, it's Iceland. Let's talk about it. It's awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just for the lack of, I guess, features in the landscapes, there's actually a lot you can do there. one place we had gone to was the Black Sand Beach was actually pretty cool. It's got some cool rock formations that kind of jut out of the water. And it's got some caves nearby that people like to get trapped in. Although it's not dangerous because they don't go in like anywhere. It's not like a giant cavern. It's just sort of like a little room. There was actually one cool place actually that I wanted to make note of was it's called Eyjastadir. You can put that in the show notes too. It's kind of hard to spell for people. It's actually in English, it's Eyjastadir. But it's one of the few places that we actually went to where it's a very like remote little village where it actually has like what look like pine trees. And you don't see trees very often in Iceland. So when you do see them, you make a mental note. You know, when you come back to New York, trees are very commonplace, but not so much there. But we had taken an unexpected detour because we were losing time on our way to this town, and we were losing daylight. So we kind of took like a back roads way that wasn't really recommended, especially in a little VW Polo that we were driving. But yeah, it's just coming down the other side of this mountain into this, I want to call it like a valley or a dale, if you will. It's one of those most like spectacular sights you'll ever see, because you've got like sporadic chunks of glacier ice all around you on the hills, but then you've got like somewhat paved road, and then you've got these like beautiful little rivers, and then you've got like some random trees and farmhouses. But
it really sounds like an incredible place to me.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. And the funny thing is, I mean, square mileage wise, it's basically the size of Great Britain, but it's only got less than 500,000 people that live on it. Because so, it's just that uninhabitable.
And it's so isolated.
Sure.
You know, being from a mountainous area, you know, in the Adirondack Mountains, you know, oftentimes we have visitors come from New York City up and they're just blown away by the how beautiful it is. And, you know, and then I see sights of Iceland and it just blows my mind on you know, how uncivilized is not what I meant. How barren the landscape is, and
sure.
And just how you can really appreciate, you know, nature out there. I guess that's what I really like about it. So
yeah, and most of the mountains that I mean, it's a very mountainous land for the most part, and the kind of the irony about that is most of those mountains are either active or dormant volcanoes, and they've got museums and stuff dedicated to, you know, which ones have erupted recently, and they've got video of certain ones going off. And yeah, it's a very rich yet, you know, somewhat violent history. And it's actually partially to blame why the land doesn't have a lot in the way of forests. They said that basically when Vikings had first settled there, they did cut down a lot of timber, obviously, to make their homes and new ships and such. But a lot of the deforestation is actually attributed to volcanic eruptions and the lava wiping these out. So the Icelandic government's actually making a concerted effort to try to repopulate the forest areas.
Wow, that's really neat. Before we go, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you say something Icelandic for us on the show?
Sure. I can say something simple like, hello or good day, which would be golden dian.
So that's awesome. So you're the first person to speak Icelandic on the show. Anything, anything else you want to teach us in Icelandic?
Trying to think, it's actually been a while since I've even spoken it.
It's been a few. I won't put you on the spot. So what was hello and goodbye again?
You can say golden dian, which means basically good day, literally translated. To say hi, you can just say hey. Goodbye. They typically, I'm not sure if it's like a cultural thing or not. Some Icelanders don't really like to say bless, but if you look at a language book, that's what goodbye would be.
Bless. Okay.
Well, that's yeah, which cool. is, yeah, two words there.
Okay. Well, let's wrap things up here.
Sure.
We had a really great time having you on the show today. I actually learned quite a bit about the whole audio recording process. It was fun to just to talk shop a little bit music-wise. One comment that sure. I wanted to say, you sort of joked about Swedish heavy metal, but I'm a big fan of just about any type of music, and I can always find something to appreciate in just about anything. And what I've always admired about heavy metal guitar players, if you take, at least from, you know, you're coming from a trumpet player, I'm not a guitar player, but watching heavy metal guitar players shred on the guitar, and take a classical guitar player playing a really difficult virtuoso classical guitar piece, their hands pretty much look exactly the same. The way that they play is very similar, and actually a lot of heavy metal players, you know, rip off things from Bach. So I mean, it's pretty awesome.
Oh sure, yeah. Some people have made a career doing that.
Absolutely, you know. So just because it's heavy metal doesn't mean you know there's a lot of great music out there. So and heavy metal is some really great stuff too. So if you want to, as a listener,
I was just gonna say, on a side note, if anyone's looking for anything that's wildly amusing, I just had to bring this up basically because you said about heavy metal guitars and the hands and all that.
Yep.
You can actually look up on YouTube, as people know, with, you know, the hard rock and heavy metal styles, people are using on electric guitars what's called distortion and massive amounts of it. It's that angry, you know, kind of distorted noisy sound. But anyway, people have actually made on YouTube videos where basically they're playing heavy metal guitar parts on guitar without the distortion.
Really?
And it's it's very interesting. Basically, people have left comments basically it sounds like, you know, surf guitar from hell type.
It's
the best
out.
Description I've seen in the comments, but if anyone wants to look that up as a general search on YouTube, it's quite entertaining.
That's awesome. And if anybody out there listening wants to learn more about Danny Lee from Danimal Sounds, you can go to his website, www.dannylee.co, and check out what he's got there. It's a great website. thanks so much for coming on the show today. I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, man, absolutely. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, and so keep us posted on your endeavors as far as the Hackintosh goes, and anything else you want to, and maybe we can make an update in a show in the future. And sure. What I'm going to do, we're going to bring things to a close here. For those of you who are listening for the first time, you can subscribe to my RSS feed. I'll put it in the show notes. That way you get the future shows and all the other past shows. You can download them right to your phone using a podcatcher of your choice. You can leave me some questions, comments for either myself or for Danny. Just send me an email, mrptechreviews@gmail.com. You can also go to my website, www.mrptechreviews.com. That's going to do it for this show. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you next time.